From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is the ER.
The email that my wife got was from a persona, described as a woman, Adriana Gavrilo, I think was the last name, claiming to be from a firm called Rubin Capital Partners out of London.
That's Colin Call. He's a Stanford professor in political science and one of those wonky but super hip guys who worked for the Obama administration. He's got bright red square glasses. He's super committed. Anyway, Call worked under Vice President Biden on the Iran deal that President Trump blew up in mid-May. But this story is only partly about the Iran deal. It's also about the ways people sought to undermine it. A few weeks ago, The Guardian and The New Yorker broke a crazy story. Black Cube, the Israeli intelligence company filled with former Mossad agents, had been hired to dig up dirt on Call and this guy Ben Rhodes, who was also a former Obama administration official. Black Cube, you might remember, it was the same company Harvey Weinstein hired to discredit the women who were accusing him of sexual misconduct. Anyway, Call and his wife, Rebecca, they didn't know any of that at the time. It all started with an email.
The email pitch that my wife got, and the email came to her on May 26, 2017, said that they had this social responsibility fund, that they had been making some investments in women's projects, and now they were shifting to education, that they had heard about my daughter's school, which is random, yeah. And that they knew that my wife was involved in the fundraising for the school, also random. This is not like public information, and that they would like to meet to discuss whether like the school might make sense to make some investments. So my wife kind of forwarded that email to some people that we know who are education consultants and also some family members who work in the finance world. And everybody thought that something about this was weird.
But so wait, okay. We all get weird, scammy emails.
Yeah.
Nigerian princes,
things
like this. Or, you know, I've gotten emails from friends and acquaintances saying that they're stuck in a country.
Totally.
That kind of thing. And you write them separately and say, has your email been hacked?
Yeah.
It didn't look like that.
No, it didn't. And well, partly because those scams, those kind of Nigerian prince scams, are generic, right? Mm-hmm. They're part of this. That's why they tend to go in your junk folder or your spam folder, right? Is that they get blasted out a lot. This was very specific, right? This was tailored, you know, my wife's name is Rebecca. Dear Rebecca. Mm-hmm. And, you know,
And there weren't the typos.
No typos. It had, you know, the name of my daughter's school. It had information that my wife was on the fundraising committee. It had...
Which is a volunteer role.
Correct.
Okay.
Your listeners need to get a volunteer role at an obscure public charter school in the corner of DC. Like it's a great school, but nobody would know about it in the UK. It's just inconceivable. And it also had kind of like official letterhead. There was a little website for the entity. It wasn't particularly deep. Mm-hmm. But it existed. Mm-hmm. So my wife forwarded this around. The folks we knew in the education and finance world thought this sounded fishy. So to test whether it was fishy or not, my wife sent back and said, look, I'm not really the person you should talk to. You should talk to the leadership of the school. Here are their names and emails. Like you should. And the person said, no, we really want to talk to you as a parent. We really want to make sure that we can talk to you. And she said, okay, well, I can't really meet with you, but here's the other parent who's on the committee with me. And actually, this other parent has three kids at the school. She knows the school way better. You should really talk to this other parent. And they're like, no, we really want to talk to you. At which point we're like, this is a scam. This is, you know, one of the people we'd reached out to in the finance world said, this sounds like something actually that a foreign intelligence entity might do. Like,
so someone introduced the idea it was foreign intel.
Yeah, and which is conceivable because I was a national security official in the Obama administration. Maybe they were, you know, but so we kind of just kind of disappeared.
And your wife does not work in national security.
No, many years ago, my wife worked for the National Democratic Institute, which is an NGO that does political development work all over the world. But about 8 years ago, she quit and got certified as a life coach. And then our daughter was born, and she essentially over time, especially as I reentered government, working 16 hours a day, 6.5 days a week, she kind of dialed all the way back to being a stay-at-home mom. Mm-hmm. So at this time, you know, she was a full-time mom. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the stuff she was doing for the school was volunteer. So we thought it was weird at the time. But what was interesting was when this Guardian Observer story came out and it said, okay, well, there was somebody fishing around in my life in this moment. She said, you remember that weird set of emails.
So it clicked for her.
It clicked for her. And I wrote a thread on Twitter that basically told the story, but without any names. Like I didn't use the term Rubin Capital Partners or anything else, but just kind of told the story. And a number of people said, you know, this really sounds like the methodology of this firm, Black Cube, this Israeli private intel firm. And then Laura Rosen, who's a reporter for Al Monitor, a really good investigative reporter, reached out to me. We know each other pretty well. And she said, can you tell me any more? And I actually gave her a screenshot of the original. And she said, well, you know, that Rubin Capital Partners is the exact same fake firm that Harvey Weinstein had hired to discredit Rose McGowan and these accusers in the you know, who had accused him of sexual assault and harassment and everything else. And then Ronan Farrow, she writes about this, and simultaneously Ronan Farrow from The New Yorker reached out to me, and I told him about the Rubin Capital Partners thing, and he said, yeah, it's the same. That's Black Cube. And then actually Ronan had a copy of the opposition file that this group had done on me.
Oh, wow.
And he's not the only one. I've also heard from reporters from NBC and The New York Times who have copies of these files. So we are now...
Have you seen it?
I have. It's not... I mean...
Did you discover something about yourself that you didn't know?
No. I mean, frankly, who knows whether this is the sum total of what they dug up on me, but it had a little bit of the feel of if you gave a research assistant 6 hours to scour the internet and, you know, get maybe a little more access to Facebook than you're supposed to.
Right.
What types of information, you know, it's like, where do I live? What's my work history? Who are my in-laws? Who are my relatives? What kind of car do I drive? You know, that type of stuff. Creepy, but not spectacularly
insightful.
You know, insightful. But the fact that these reporters had it, I think at this point we are 100% sure that it was this entity, Black Cube, that was hired. I think the $64,000 question is who hired them. Mm-hmm. The Observer and Guardian continue to assert that they've either seen documents or they have credible allegations that it was Trump aides or Trump associates. Others have said maybe it's a corporate client in the Gulf or somewhere else. So I think that's the next shoe to drop is to figure out who hired these guys.
Because that's unclear.
It is unclear. I mean, so I don't have any direct evidence other than what's been reported. Mm-hmm. And the two stories that have been reported, one is that, you know, it was Trump aides, and the other is that it was a corporate client. Of course, these explanations aren't mutually exclusive. My guess is if there's any connection back to anybody in Trump world, there's no reason you shouldn't expect to see a contract with some Trump aide signature on it, right? It would be one or two hops removed, some wealthy donor or some corporate entity that they know or something else. I do think, though, that to figure out who hired these folks, one has to answer two questions. One is, why did they target Ben Rhodes and I specifically as a pair? Mm-hmm. Because after all, like, we were senior officials, but there were other more senior officials. Mm-hmm. We were involved in the Iran deal, but hardly an exhaustive list. Mm-hmm. You know, John Kerry and Ernie Moniz and Wendy Sherman and Susan Rice. And, you know, there's a lot of other people who could have been targeted. So why the two of us? Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is, why the timing? Why the spring of 2017? And those two things put together of Ben and I as a pair and the timing is what makes, I think, at least the notion that it's tied back to Trump associates plausible, because there was this obsession that a number of Trump aides had with Ben and I specifically in the spring of 2017. And so maybe it's just a coincidence that they had obsession.
But why in the spring of 2017?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think a couple of reasons. One. Ben and I were very active in both the media and on social media in criticizing the Trump administration, probably to a degree that is abnormal of former government officials. Usually there's a little bit of a cooling off period. I think it was different this time because a lot of Obama administration officials, especially those of us who were there through the very end, saw so many disturbing things about the incoming administration during the transition that I think there was a sense of existential anxiety about the administration that's not typical. So I think people were more actively critical than is typical, and Ben and I were pretty far out there. I think that's the first thing. I think the second is that there was a set of aides close to Trump who were obsessed with the series of leaks, right? Leaked transcripts to foreign leader calls, right? Leaks about the Russia stuff to the to the Washington Press or the New York Times and others, leaks about, you know, what Trump might have told Lavrov in the Oval Office. Like, they were just obsessed with trying to figure out who the leakers were. And for whatever reason, they zeroed in on Ben and I as the most likely puppet masters of the deep state. And this sounds crazy, by the way. This sounds absolutely freaking crazy, except that apparently they believed it.
At any point, did you worry about your family and things like that, though? I mean, when that email came in, did you make any connection at that point, A, to the Trump administration or to any other, you know, kind of trolley kind of things? And B, did you start worrying, oh, well, you know, at least my wife's not involved in this?
So I think it was at the time I didn't draw any connection to the Trump administration. And once again, I still don't have any smoking gun evidence that they were involved now, even after all the reporting. So I think we found it was creepy. I think the fact that once my wife stopped engaging, this persona at least left us alone. There were probably maybe half a dozen emails back and forth between May 26th and I think the last email was June 15th of 2017. They didn't stalk us after that. Mm-hmm. I do think there was some separate outreach to me. Looking back at my Gmail, there appears to have been some outreach from what I think is a fake French think tank at the same time to try to set up a similar meeting with me.
Mm-hmm. But was it also so, like, strangely off subject or no?
No, that the French think tank one was a little bit more plausible. Mm-hmm. Because they wanted to invite me to Paris to be on a panel to talk about the Obama administration's non-proliferation legacy, including the Iran deal and some other, which is not unusual because I'm an academic, I'm a think tanker, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I write about this stuff, I do stuff like this all the time. What was weird about it was that I could find no information that this think tank actually existed. And it was another one of these things where I kept trying to push them off and they were very insistent on meeting with me. And So there were some creepy things that were happening, but I don't think we ever felt at personal risk. Because I don't think the goal was ever to do us physical harm. I think the goal was to try to dig up dirt on us. I'm still not sure exactly what that dirt would be. We're mm-hmm. pretty boring middle class people.
But blackmail of some kind?
Yeah, I guess. I guess. My guess is, look, if this Black Cube agent had set up a meeting with my wife, what they appear to have done in other cases is essentially they surreptitiously video the whole thing, right? So they put down like a briefcase that's got like a video camera and they videotape yeah. the whole thing. And then, you know, probably they would have tried to offer to make big investments in my daughter's school, but maybe with a finder's fee, okay. right? Like some, yeah. like a commission, mm-hmm. you know, we don't, you know, it's like something that my wife never would have accepted to begin with, but if somebody had accepted it, you could frame it as corruption, mm-hmm. right, of some mm-hmm. sort, or illegal, or use it as blackmail or something. Maybe they would have tried to befriend my wife and try to, like, solicit, I don't know, salacious information about me or stuff in our, get access to our financial situation or whatever. I don't know. So all of that is extraordinarily creepy that mm-hmm. anybody would do that, period. But I don't think the goal was to harm us. The goal was to try to dig up dirt to discredit us.
But once this came out in the yeah. Observer and the New Yorker and wherever it comes from, did you feel that something had been breached? I mean, it was something different, right? I mean, it isn't you anymore. It's actually your family has somehow been exposed to something. How did that feel?
Yeah. So I think there are actually two or three mm-hmm. normative breaches that, mm-hmm. that happen here. I said, you know, the first I would, you know, when you're a government official, especially when you work in the national security space, you assume you're the target mm-hmm. of foreign intelligence entities, right? Okay. You assume that they're going to try to hack your email. They're going to try to listen into your phone conversations. They're going to surveil you on foreign trips. Like, that's what intelligence entities do. When you're a foreign official, you know, our spies do stuff like that. Their spies do stuff like that. It's not.
And are you trained to deal with it?
Well, I mean, you go through counterintelligence right. training and you know, be on the lookout for phishing scams mm-hmm. and, you know, you only use secure communications for classified information and all sorts of other things. But the notion that you're spied on as an official is not unusual. Mm-hmm. It is very unusual that you would be spied on as a former official, mm-hmm. right? A former official who's now just going back to being a college professor at Georgetown University. And especially that they would be going after you to try to dig up dirt on something that you did for public policy reasons to try to make the country safer, and try to use somehow dirt on you to discredit that or your policy position. So it's very unusual. So I think the first normative breach was kind of going after me, period, as a former official. The second normative breach was going at me through my family, right? Bringing my wife into this and also using my daughter's school as the vector, that's just gross. It's so sleazy and creepy and it's just awful. And maybe that happens in the corporate world all the time where folks get hired to dig up blackmail to use in litigation or in negotiations. It doesn't happen in my world. It's not okay, period. And going after my family is just awful. And the third normative breach is if this has any connection to the U.S. government, then we are talking about the U.S. government hiring a foreign intelligence firm to not only spy on but to dig up dirt on political opponents and to go after their families. Right. That is so that takes you into like the authoritarian realm of creepiness. The other things are bad enough. That third one, which we don't yet have, I think, conclusive evidence for, takes you into an entirely different level of terrible.
You know, there's something about the Iran deal, though, that was so personal to the president. Right. And it was personal to everyone working on it. And one of the things I've been wondering about, you know, and I've talked to a handful of people who had worked on the deal, you know, extensively, that it actually took a toll on the families to work on it because it was so many hours over so much time. Did you watch him speak?
I did. Yeah. I was at the gym at Stanford University where I'm teaching now. While that speech was on, I watched it on my iPad while I was on the elliptical or something, trying not to fall off while watching him. Look, I mean, the biggest consequences for this are the consequences for the world, and we should talk about that. But I do think that the people who were involved in this felt it deeply at a personal level. And I should start by saying that, while people like myself and Ben and others at the White House worked a lot on this, the real people who put this together, of course, were our diplomats, our intelligence folks, and others who literally spent months away from their families, camped out in hotels in Vienna, working out the details of this and grinding away at this. This was not a one-off, you know, reality show summit with a foreign leader. This was, you know, many years of deliberations, negotiations, technical discussions. And so, yeah, I mean, the person hours that went into this and the sacrifices of people away from their families and everything else. And everybody was doing it for the right reasons. That is, they were doing it to try to make the United States safer and to make the world better. Now, by the way, it is totally free. I mean, it's totally fine to criticize us on policy grounds, right? Maybe the deal was a bad deal. I don't agree with that, but we can be criticized. It. Maybe we didn't negotiate in the right way. I think we did, but that's fair game. But no one should impugn the motives of the people involved in this. Everybody who was involved in this was a professional and a patriot trying to do the right thing for their country. And so, yes, when this thing, when you know, Trump just tears it up, it was demoralizing because I know how many person hours went into this, how much sacrifice went into this, how hard people worked to craft something good, and it was tossed away essentially on the whim of a president who doesn't understand the deal.
You've written for Foreign Policy on the fact that there really is no military option. There was no military option from the Israelis and no military option from us.
So when I say there's no military option, it depends on what the goal is. Do we have the military capabilities to set back Iran's nuclear program? Undoubtedly. We can blow up the Natanz enrichment facility. We could blow up the reactor at Arak. We could do big damage to the Fordo enrichment facility in this, you know, buried 300 feet under this mountain near the holy city of Qom in Iran. We could go after the Esfahan conversion facility. We could do a lot of damage, and we could do more damage than the Israelis could. But our assessment, I think, was that the Israelis could, if the Israelis used essentially their entire air force to go after Iran's nuclear program, they could maybe set the program back by a year or two. We could probably do it about twice as much damage. So you can have an effect of setting the program back, mm-hmm. let's say 2 to 4 years. But then you'll just have to mow the lawn,
right?
Because they will rebuild the program. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they'll be more motivated to rebuild their program because it'll now be the only way to deter the United States from doing this again. And so the Iran nuclear, so a military option buys you a few years. The Iran nuclear deal bought you at least 15 years.
That's what I was going to ask.
And so there's just no question. One buys you a couple years. The other buys you minimum 15 years. One motivates them to drive towards a nuclear weapons capability. That's the military option. The other actually creates an incentive structure that maybe disincentivizes them to go for nuclear weapons over the long term. And by the way, one produces another big war in the Middle East and the other doesn't.
I'm curious, when you watched Benjamin Netanyahu do his
TED Talk.
His PowerPoint, what were you thinking? Were you thinking this is the end? Was it new material?
So I think the answer to that is yes. Whether it's new, the answer is yes and no.
Okay.
So the first thing I thought is this is a TED Talk with an audience of one.
Mm-hmm.
All right. That having seen the European officials come through, Macron, Merkel, making the last ditch case for sticking with the Iran deal, this was Netanyahu standing up to give like the closing argument mm-hmm. in court, right? But there's only one juror, and that's Trump. So it's clear what it was, transparent what it was for. Even the kind of splashy, you know, PowerPoint slides, like Iran lied big time, right? Like just even the framing of the presentation is very Trumpian. Netanyahu was litigating the past in order to shape a particular future that he wanted Donald Trump to pursue, and he won. He got his way. But no, there was nothing earth-shattering about his presentation, which is, I think, why it was largely met, frankly, with a degree of ridicule in the Washington establishment and in Israel.
But did your heart sink when you saw it, or did you think it's the same show as it was in 2015?
It didn't. Well, on the Iran deal, he was never in favor of cutting a deal with Iran for Netanyahu, who I've been in probably a dozen meetings with him and other U.S. senior officials over the last decade. It's always been about regime change in Iran for him. No deal with this regime could be acceptable. He obviously went around the Obama White House to schedule a joint address to Congress, you'll remember, in the spring of 2015 to blast against the deal and to establish a set of standards for a good deal that nobody believed could be achieved, except mm-hmm. maybe now Donald Trump believes it. So actually, there was nothing surprising about what Netanyahu did. And by the time he actually gave that speech, I think myself and a number of other close observers of this were pretty convinced Trump was going to do what he did anyway. But the moment he gave the speech and then Trump said, see, that proves what I feel about the deal 100%, I think it was, the rest of it was, history.
Do you feel personally anxious, though, now after this experience with Black Cube?
Well, I think this particular operation appears to have stopped
mm-hmm.
in the summer of last year.
Yeah.
I'm hopeful that by bringing attention to it, not only can we find out what happened and hopefully hold some of the people who did this to account, but then maybe the sunlight's a little bit of a deterrent. I don't know. I mean, at the end of the day, I'm not an important enough person to like, boy, if we could just bump off Colin Call, we actually would change like so many things. So, and I'm not particularly anxious in the sense that, we are pretty boring middle-class people. I don't think we have a lot of skeletons in our closet.
I don't mean that. I mean about what it means for governing. Or governance, what it means for how we go about changing policy, because you talked about breaches. It's one thing to criticize a policy; it's another thing to try to unravel the personal lives of the people who worked on that policy.
Yeah, that's actually a very insightful point. I think that if this became more commonplace, that it became a regular thing, a regular rhythm, that people who went into government, the second they left government, foreign entities, foreign companies, and or, incoming administrations started to generate, files of blackmail material, compromat, essentially, against foreign officials, then the obvious effect of that is people aren't going to serve.
Right.
right? Because they are not going to want to put themselves and their families through that. So I do worry very much about that. I obviously worry about, you know, if our current government was involved in any way in commissioning this, then of course this is straight out of the authoritarian playbook, right? And so that's a much more existential question about the state of our democracy. But even if they're not involved at all, if we start to get in this habit, this pattern of going after foreign officials for the good work that they did for the right reasons in government, then good people aren't going to serve in government. And the worst people in government, the worst government we have. I think we're seeing that in real time.
Colin Call, thank you so much for coming into our studios.
Sure. Great to be here. Thanks.
You've been listening to Foreign Policy's The ER Podcast. I'm Sarah Wildman, and I've been your host. The podcast is produced by Shelby Bosted. For more information about foreign policy and to subscribe to The ER, please visit foreignpolicy.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.